Hospital, Mr. Pavich.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Robert Pavich. I represent the appellant plaintiff in the case. This is a case in which summary judgment was entered against us on count one of our complaint. Count one was brought under the Emergency Medical Transport Active Labor Act, which provides that once an emergency medical condition has been diagnosed or determined, the patient cannot be either discharged or transferred until that condition has been stabilized. In this case, the trial court found that there was no material question as to whether or not the patient had been stabilized. We believe that the evidence shows at least that there was a factual question as to whether or not the patient had been stabilized. Cheryl Thomas was brought into the hospital and diagnosed in the emergency room with steroid-induced psychosis. This came from an administration of prednisone that you've been given in order to relieve a respiratory condition. It's not unknown and is well documented in the literature. Once that diagnosis was made in the emergency room, and by the way, counsel for the hospital is not contesting that this was in fact an emergency medical condition under EMTALA. Once that diagnosis was made, no treatment was given. The patient was discharged without treatment and was discharged with the same diagnosis, that is.
And when was she discharged?
The same evening, Your Honor, from the emergency room. She was not admitted.
All right.
She was discharged with a provisional diagnosis of prednisone or steroid-induced psychosis. There's no indication that any treatment was given from the time she was admitted and diagnosed from the time to the time she was discharged. And therefore, we contend that under the Act, she was, as a matter of fact, had not been stabilized. Wouldn't you look at the act?
When did the incident happen? How many hours after?
The incident which caused her death occurred on Monday. This was Friday night.
How many hours after it?
This would have been 3 days later, Your Honor. 3 days.
96 hours?
Approximately.
That condition going on for that long has stabilized?
No, in fact, Your Honor, it deteriorated. And in
after
fact, if
three
we get
days?
Into... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
After three full days?
This is a condition that, if we got into the issue of causation, which we didn't, but if we did, this is a condition that's well known to continue for weeks, if not months, if it is not treated.
Well, here's the problem, I think, because I think causation is a big problem. She not only does 3 days pass, but she goes to see her own doctor, right, Dr. Palmer.
That's
correct. Isn't that an intervening cause?
No, it's not, Your Honor.
That prevents the finding of damages against the hospital under Illinois law?
No, it's not, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because this was not a superseding cause. This was a foreseeable result of the, if we get into a negligence count, which we're not now, we're talking EMTALA, but if we had to go to a negligence count, our experts are prepared to say that what happened here, the discharge, which itself was below the standard of care, to an internist who is not a psychiatrist, not someone who is equipped to deal with a psychiatric condition, would not likely lead to treatment that would be effective with this condition. And the
then
fact
why
that
didn't her own internist refer her to a psychiatrist? Who knows her better or her problem better than her own internist?
In fact, he said that, and part of the reason that he did not refer her is he was relying on the discharge from the hospital. He's not a psychiatrist. He felt that the people at the hospital...
No, but he's an internist. And an internist's obligation is, as I understand it,
that's correct,
to refer him to the specialist that can handle a problem if he can't handle it.
That's exactly what our expert against the internist has said, Your Honor, and that's in counts one and counts two, which are not part of it.
Well, that's an intervening cause, as Judge Williams just said.
No, it's not an intervening cause if this is foreseeable. An intervening cause has to be one which is not foreseeable. Here, to send someone to an internist with no specific time frame as the hospital...
Her own doctor.
Yes.
Her own doctor, not just an internist.
Yes. In fact, this was the doctor who had treated her with the prednisone. That's
right,
correct.
Right, right. And who had prescribed it and obviously should have watched her.
Well, that's part of counts one and count two. That's correct, Your Honor. But it is foreseeable that being seen by an internist on a Monday would not lead to immediate treatment, would not lead to a referral to a psychiatrist. And that's not the issue, however, I must say, that was before the court here. I must bring, with all due respect, bring us back to the issue that was before this court, and that's simply whether or not this discharge violated EMTALA. We are prepared to deal with the issue of causation with expert testimony, but we didn't get to that point. We have experts from the field of psychiatry or board certified who can deal with the issue of causation. We have experts from the field of emergency medicine. We can deal with that issue. We never got to that issue, Your Honors.
Well, are you saying that Dr. Zane and Dr. Elkin were prepared to testify that there was that a material deterioration of her condition was likely to occur when she was discharged?
In fact, that it did occur. That material deterioration did occur. That was their opinion. When they followed her for those 3 days, there were examples that they could point to that supported their opinion that her condition materially deteriorated. She did not sleep during that period. She refused to
right,
go home.
I understand, but I was asking a different question. Would they be prepared to testify that, you know, based on the examination at the hospital, that it would be likely to deteriorate? I understand your
yes, position. That's the nature of the condition. They not only would be prepared to do so, they have done so in their depositions. This is the nature of the condition of prednisone or steroid-induced psychosis. If it is not treated, it is likely to deteriorate and manifest itself in risk-taking behavior, including reckless driving. That's from the standards of the American Psychiatric Association, which have been relied upon This is a common manifestation. We can never say can in the abstract. We can only say that patients who suffer from this condition will experience or will undertake this kind of risk-taking behavior. And the practice guidelines of the American Psychiatric Association include, among that risk-taking behavior, specifically reckless driving. We are prepared to deal with that issue. We never got to that issue, Your Honors. I think that what is before the court here is the preliminary issue, and that is the issue of whether or not the discharge violated EMTALA. We believe that it did because we presented evidence specifically indicating that she was still had the same condition that had gone untreated from the time she was brought in until the time she was discharged. We can deal with the proximate cause issue. We have experts who are prepared to do that. I think, with all due respect, Your Honor, I think it would be unfair for us to not be given an opportunity to deal with the preliminary issue. We're prepared to deal with the proximate cause issue, and we can do so. Our experts have done so in their reports and in their depositions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Panditch. Ms. Hannigan?
We're asking the court to uphold the decision of the trial court. For purposes of EMTALA, we believe that the patient was stable at discharge. The statute provides a specific definition for stable. According to the Act, a patient is stable when no material deterioration of the patient's condition is likely, within reasonable medical probability, to result from discharge. This is the first time.
What if she said that if they didn't admit her to the hospital, she was going to kill herself? Would there then be a violation of the statute?
That might be considered a material deterioration. In this case,
she did end up getting killed. So,
but at the time of her evaluation at the hospital, there was no indication that she was suicidal or homicidal.
Well, I don't think she was suicidal or homicidal.
Well, that goes back to the
There's
issue.
There's no indication that she was committing suicide.
No, but it's a question almost of foreseeability, whether there is a likely
material deterioration. Homicidal, suicidal. She was asked about that, but if you think that, you know, if you see ghosts and you think your husband is trying to kill you, you're quite likely to try to escape in some loony fashion, which is what she did. So I should think those risks would have been obvious to responsible medical people, and that's what the expert evidence suggests.
Well, I disagree with that. I think when you look at the statute in its entirety and you give plain meaning to the terms in the statute, material implies that it's a significant something significant is going on. Deterioration is a worsening of the condition, and medical probability is more likely than not.
Well, you agreed that if she had indicated a suicidal tendency, that the hospital would have been required to admit her. You admit
I,
that.
I would agree that's
material. So it's just a question of, you know,
degree.
It's a question of fact, whether this, whether what your opponent described is, you know, the propensity for risk-taking behavior, including reckless driving, is sufficient to render her condition unstable. Why wouldn't that be a factual issue?
Taking the statute in its entirety, their evidence is this. Mr. Kemp testified that if Sherelle Thomas were discharged from the hospital, she might. Not that she probably would.
See, that's of course what Kemp says. He's an employee of the hospital. But you've got expert evidence going the other way.
Dr. Zane testified in his deposition that he could not anticipate if she were discharged that she would become involved in this accident.
Well, of course not. You don't know what will happen. All you know is that these people are in extreme danger to themselves because they're completely detached from reality.
Well, this
is you're released into the custody of the person you think is trying to kill you, you're likely to do something weird in trying to escape, jump out of a window. Who knows what this person might have done? The fact that the particular disaster was not foreseen is irrelevant to whether a responsible medical people at the hospital would have realized this person was in danger and shouldn't be and should be under lock and key until her condition did stabilize in a realistic sense.
Well, there is no evidence that this patient was homicidal or suicidal at the time.
We've been through that,
okay.
Right? That's irrelevant.
The issue is, was she at risk of harm? Well, every patient is at risk of harm.
No, was she at risk of harm because of her condition? Because she might do something crazy. It wouldn't have to be suicidal or homicidal. Well, it could be homicidal, try to kill her husband. But she could do something very dangerous. That's what psychotics do. So,
I can't...
And why wouldn't the hospital just keep her? I understand she was instructed to discontinue use of the steroid medication, to make an appointment to be evaluated by Palmer within 24 hours and return to the emergency room if her condition deteriorated before seeing Palmer. But obviously this kind of steroid remains in your system for some period.
Well, when you discontinue the steroid,
right,
the anticipation that the symptoms are lessened.
Right, but it still lingers. I mean, there's no indication of how long she would be under the influence.
But the instructions also included to return to the ER if there were any continuing problems.
But you're instructing an irrational person. I don't understand how you could think that instructing an irrational person is a way of discharging your responsibility for the person's safety.
It's not just instructing the person, and there was no evidence that she was incapable of making treatment decisions for herself. The family was there, and they instructed, and they agreed. So it's not just discharging a single individual out into the street. There's a treatment plan. I think the plaintiff kind of misspoke in terms of no treatment being rendered at the hospital. There was an assessment. There was treatment. It was outpatient treatment, and I think that's where the plaintiff disagrees, is they wanted inpatient treatment. I think that's really more an issue of medical malpractice and not statutory violation.
I don't actually see what the difference is. I've never seen the statute before, but isn't this a statute which imposes some federal duty of care on emergency rooms? I guess there was some history of emergency rooms turning people away, so you're not allowed to turn someone away who's in danger. Isn't that what it is?
Well, this is the purpose of the statute, to assure that emergency medical care is provided to people whether or not they can pay. And that's what the hospital did in this case. She was brought to the hospital, she was assessed, she was diagnosed, and they gave her a treatment plan. And that treatment plan is going back to Dr. Palmer.
I thought you agreed earlier that if their assessment is negligent, then they fail, right? If she'd said, we have this in prison cases all the time. We have prison suicides, and the question is, we actually usually in jails, were the jail officials negligent or actually deliberately indifferent to the risk of suicide. So, and if they are, then, you know, there's a violation. So isn't it the same thing here? If there's a serious risk and they disregard it, then they violated the statute. Isn't that what we don't concede
that there was an emergency
medical
condition.
I know you
condition.
Don't, but is that the right standard?
There's a
serious risk to the person's safety, then they can't send her away.
Well, the case law actually is that you have to diagnose the emergency medical condition or else you're not held to the standard of stabilizing. We don't believe she had an emergency medical condition. Even if you do, when you look at stabilization, other courts who have interpreted the language of the statute say a patient's stable when the vital signs are stable, when the patient's not in acute distress, when the condition's not worsening, or when the condition is not life-threatening. And she didn't have any of that. And all that Kemp says is that...
Well, what if someone fainted and came into the emergency room and they looked in her brain or something and said, well, you have some lesion here, and well, you may faint again, you may drop dead in 2 days, but we don't really know. It's just one of those things.
Is it probably potentially life-threatening?
How would the law treat that case?
It depends on the potential for harm. Here, all we have is might.
How would you deal with my case?
We take your scenario, and it's likely that there's a significant serious health threat. Yes, that patient's not stable.
Well, there was a serious health risk here.
Well,
very serious.
All we have here is a psychotic. Mr. Kemp.
Well, that's a serious risk, especially when the psychotic believes that the person in whose custody she's being released is a potential murderer of her.
Well, the only evidence is that she may spend money foolishly, she may act out against her husband, but not homicide, or she may engage in socially compromising situations.
Now, that's not the only evidence from the expert.
All the expert says is that she is at risk of harm, essentially. He agrees that...
He didn't say the only risks were financial.
No, Kemp is not the expert. Kemp is your social worker in the hospital.
No, the expert witness is...
Dr. Zane said that there was a risk of harm, some undefined risk of harm, but he could not have foreseen that she would have killed herself.
Is that a material deterioration?
Everybody's at risk for harm.
What?
Everyone is at risk for harm. Their condition could worsen.
She wasn't everyone.
She had a medical condition that was diagnosed. She needed treatment. It was outpatient treatment. It's not a situation where you've got somebody who's hypertensive in active labor. So we're asking the court to affirm entry of summary judgment because we really believe that the issue that's left is a malpractice issue, whether treatment should have been inpatient or outpatient. We don't believe there's any evidence of stability or lack of stability.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Hannigan. Mr. Pavich, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
The counsel made a comment that there was no evidence that Cheryl Thomas's judgment was impaired. In fact, the medical record by Mr. Kemp under judgment indicates severe impairment, insight severe impairment, delusions severe paranoia, mood manic. Clearly her judgment was impaired, and yet she was the one that the hospital relied upon in giving the discharge instructions in order to ensure that she would follow through with these instructions.
Didn't they give it to her family too?
She was the one who was actually signed the discharge, not the husband.
But didn't they give it to her family?
They discussed it with the family.
Right.
It's not clear how specific it was, but she was the one who was requested to sign the discharge. A discharge instruction which, by the way, indicates that her most severe problem was smoking. She's not a smoker, but this is part of the form under the discharge instruction that this psychotic patient was given at the time of the discharge.
Did she drink that night? Did she went out to eat and have the accident too?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did she have any alcohol?
No.
Did
no,
she
Your
consume
Honor.
Any that night?
No.
She
was in the movie theater. She was in a movie
eat
theater.
With her and to dine with her husband.
No alcohol to our knowledge, Your Honor. None. our concern, frankly, Your Honors, is that that this court, as did the trial court, would be focusing on the issue of causation, and we've not had an opportunity to really address that. I can tell you that our experts are prepared to address it. They have addressed it. This is a condition that normally takes several weeks of medication before the behavior will be adjusted, and that's why a protected environment is required for a patient such as this. Whether it's 1 day, 2 days, 3 weeks, even when treatment is begun, it's recognized that it will take 2 to 3 or even more weeks before the behavior will be affected. So that I
where did you get that from?
This is from the
I've
American
taken
Psychiatric.
It 3 different times. That's what I want to know. I've never seen that.
Yes, because
it was a withdrawal of over 5 days. 5 pills, 4 pills, 3 pills, 2 pill, 1 pill.
Talking about the prednisone.
Yeah, we're not talking about withdrawing the prednisone.
Are you talking about these?
We're talking about the administration of antipsychotic drugs in order to treat the patient.
But she wasn't taking any antipsychotic drugs.
That's the point. She needed them. That's the entire point.
Well, isn't that malpractice then?
That's counts one and count two of this complaint against Dr. Palmer. Yes, yes. But I ask you, please.
How is it causation back to the hospital?
Because the causation, the line of the causation never ends. Our expert has simply said, you have a condition that's diagnosed.
It's and 72 hours later, it takes effect rather than 96 hours.
No, it doesn't take effect. It continues.
This
risk-taking behavior continues until you treat it. It will continue for weeks, months. You need to treat it. The fact that she may not have been taking the prednisone only removes the source. It does not remove what's in her system and what's causing the behavior. Causation was not what was before the court. What was before this court was the issue of whether or not she was stable when she left. Clearly, there's a fact question as to whether or not she was stable. If we're given the opportunity to address causation, I can assure this court we will do so, and we will confront it directly.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pavis. Thank you, Ms. Hannigan.
You,
last case for argument, United States versus Huebner, Mr. Minkus.